need to make enough noise like Bam Bam. Throw boulders from bedrock, you'll get dropped by Slam Man. So check it, I'm rigging the record quick. Oh, shucks, I give it to got big ducks like Daddy Quark Bucks. Oh, Anna, I'm rigging the rock, the Coca Cabana. Banana, split, hot, hook, spit, so sick. I'm rigging the freaking from here to Bangladesh. I'm rigging the ripping flesh, but I get fresh like this. Shish, rigging the shush, kid, you'll get done. For fun, I riggedy rhyme like no one. I riggedy bum, riggedy rust, chickedy jumps, I'm savage. I shake them up and down like the Dow Jones average. I'm cocky like Rocky, I riggedy bangs the best. So diggedy tell your friend chum, cause here comes Dasa Vex.
Yeah,
this episode of Mike Check It is with my man, Anthony Kiyoko. Dope dude, man, brother from Minneapolis. He has a hell of a story of his trials and tribulations on his way to being. He's actually a morning anchor and reporter on KMOV4 here, CBS Network here in St. Louis. Dope dude. Great conversation we have about his, like I said, his whole trajectory, what he went to, how he got there, and all the different things that he's doing now within his career and where he's trying to go. It's very, very dope. You know, we always have great conversations on My Checker. So definitely enjoy this conversation as well. Email us straightolc@gmail.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes, you know, Straight Outlaw Cash on iTunes, as well as hit the fan page, Straight Outlaw Cash fan page. Tweet us straightolc. Definitely, I know everybody gave us a lot of great feedback from the brand new episode of Straight Outta Low Cash. As you see, we're back full effect with the funny and knowledge always is that we could provide. So yeah, I hope you all enjoyed this episode, and check you out on next side.
I never said I had a business mind. I just don't believe that quitting time exists. Ain't no finish line to this. You gotta give me mine. I really shine. My given time is this. Live and die with the grind, driven by the fist. Where do you place my name if I never played your game? We don't race the same. I don't run inside no painted lane. Plus, y'all pace is strange. Y'all either stop or you sprint. Run when it's sunny and hot if it changed to rain. I wouldn't be half the Ali that I am if I slowed myself up and tried competing with.
All right, welcome back to Mike Check It. I'm here with my guest, Anthony Kiyoko, right?
Kiko.
University of Minnesota grad, yeah. Channel 4. Was it anchor now? Reporter? What is, I guess, your
anchor
official?
Anchor and reporter. Mix, you know, you can catch me early in the morning, Monday through Friday, 5 a.m. Starting. And then sometimes I'll anchor in the morning and also at noon.
Okay, so you do the midday kind of thing too sometimes.
Yeah, occasionally I have a long day that lasts until noon and you can catch me anchoring that show.
Is that pretty challenging with the?
Oh yeah, I mean we start at 3 a.m. So I show up at the office downtown 3 a.m. and usually I'm there at least until 11. But if I do the noon, then I'm there until about 12:45. So yeah, it's a long day, and then
you have to repeat the same process again the next day.
Yep, 5 days a week. So usually while everybody else is getting ready to go, really kind of start their lunch hour, that's when I'm getting ready to getting close to go to sleep. So, yeah.
Dang. No. Like I said, I appreciate you coming on, man. Let's go into your story, man, because your story to me is a dope story, and there's a lot of people who need to kind of hear that for inspiration. Not is even more people listening are grown people, I assume, in general, but in the idea and the process that everybody has to go through, because everybody's got a story. My uncle always told me everything you're going through is your story.
Yeah.
So let's start from the beginning of your kind of upbringings and, you know, kind of where you come from.
Well, okay, so I was born in South Minneapolis. My father's black, my mother's white. Got a couple siblings.
Is it Minneapolis North supposed to be the hood part, though?
North and South have some
hood areas, huh?
More difficult areas.
Okay. Shout out to my homie Shaquita Bell. She's from you might know her. She's from Minneapolis. She went to Minneapolis North.
Okay,
with Khalid
Alamin
and all that.
My brother went to North. So yeah, I know some people definitely in that area. Was in South Minneapolis till I was probably about 13, and then we moved out to a suburb of Minneapolis, Brooklyn Park, when my father and mother
That's
split.
That's where my uncle lived there for a long time. Yeah.
Yep, so we moved out there when I was about 13.
Was that a culture change? Because Brooklyn Park is like totally different, it feels like, than the actual city of Minneapolis.
We actually moved to an area that was low-income housing.
Okay, so it wasn't like the Brooklyn Park.
it was a much more diverse area than the rest of Brooklyn Park.
Okay.
So when we lived in that area, you know, I had people around me who I was used to seeing, who I felt comfortable with.
Okay, okay. That's what I was going to say, because the rest of Brooklyn Park isn't like that. Yeah.
No, so that's where we lived. You know, my younger brother, my sister, and my mom. And
so are you the oldest?
I am in the middle.
Okay.
I'm in the middle.
So the sister is the oldest, then you, then your other brother.
Older sister. And so we were there for most of my teenage years. Basically, probably around 14 is kind of when I lost my way. That summer in between 9th grade and 10th grade is when I really started to kind of go down the wrong path and make some poor choices, you know, fooling around with drugs and with people, you know, who were, you know, making bad choices and not taking their future seriously. So then freshman year of high school starts, and, you know, I basically stopped going to school on the second day. And that was it for me.
In sophomore year?
Freshman year. So this is when I was 15 years old.
So you weren't even legally able to drop out yet?
No. No, I was not. And that's a whole nother story in itself. But I stopped going to school. Eventually, I did, or I was taken to court for truancy, but what happened was by the time my court date came around, I had already turned 16 and they couldn't do anything about it. So it was a weird situation where the law worked out in my favor at that time, but, you know, looking back, it's definitely not something that I, you know, am happy about. Yeah. I wish that I would have continued in school, but I fought tooth and nail because I just was not interested in school at all. I was much more interested in, you know, hanging out with friends and making other poor decisions. So fast forward a couple years later, I had become a father by then, and worked, you know, probably a dozen or so odd jobs doing nothing, and then also, you know, doing some things, you know, outside of work that weren't necessarily the smartest choices.
Hustling, a little bit of hustling.
Yeah, and at some point, though, I came to the realization that I wanted more for myself. I wanted more for my son. So I got a GED, and then I took a community college class. I took an English course.
How long did that process take for you to get a GED? Like,
you know, it took a while, actually. I did go to some classes for it. So for probably like 2 or 3 months, I went to some sessions. There was like a community center where I could go, and there were some teachers there, and I was there like with other people who had dropped out or other people who had recently moved to the country, and we're all studying.
So it's a mix of different
types of people. And we were all studying for our GED. Eventually, I took the test, passed it, received that. So that was a good accomplishment that I was happy about. And then after that, I decided to enroll in an English class in a community college right by my school, or excuse me, by my home. And I did really well in the class. I got a B, but I did well as far as some of the things that I wrote and some of the interactions that I had with my professor. And it just kind of snowballed from there. I took a few more classes at the community college, and I did really well. And I ended up getting a scholarship to the big university in Minnesota, the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. So after maybe 2 years at the community college, I transferred to the University of Minnesota.
Let's go back a little bit. What made you decide, like you know, like what was the point where you're like, you know what, I gotta do something different? Like, was there a moment that you was like, you know what, like everybody has that kind of moment where you're sitting somewhere, or like are people, when they say they get married, they sit somewhere like in some club and they're like, I don't want none of these girls, I'm gonna go and get married,
you know,
or like the defining moment?
There were a few things. At one point, I worked at a hotel, and I was, like, cleaning, conference rooms. And I would run into a lot of business people, like, coming and going, coming in and out of town, riding in limos, back and forth. And their life looked so cool. Like, it looked like, how come my life didn't turn out like that, I would say.
But you don't understand that they probably depressed on the back end, too, though, so that's a whole nother...
Probably. But eventually, I just started to think about it a little bit more, and I realized that really the only difference between them and me is that they had an education and I did it. So that's kind of when I really decided, oh, you know, that's probably the path for me to go. You know, I need to do something to, you know, make myself more educated, make myself more intelligent, and more marketable for potential jobs, so that I'm not, you know, stuck in a job that I don't enjoy for the rest of my life. So that's when I decided to get the GED, and then I decided to attend community college. And like I said, I did well there, and, you know, it just kind of snowballed. It was like, you know, I did well in one class, and then I did even better in the next class. And, you know, I started to realize that I liked school and that I liked learning, and I liked things that, you know, when I was a teenager, I had no interest in at all, that I enjoyed it. I enjoyed school. It was just a whole different atmosphere. And then things really, you know, took off when I went to the University of Minnesota. It was difficult initially when I went there because, like you mentioned, that was a culture shock for me because I went there. I was always the only minority in my class. There were never any other students in my class of color aside from the African-American history courses that
right,
I took,
like,
which,
like,
would
be talk about that early.
Which would be packed with
right,
black folks.
We talked about that earlier with professorships. Yeah.
So that was like a little
breather.
Yeah, a breather from what I was dealing with in the other courses. And then I was also older than some of the students. I didn't live on campus, and I also was a father, so I had different challenges. And it was difficult. There were times that I thought about quitting school, like, you know, maybe I'm just not cut out for this. I'm doing too much, you know, thinking like, okay, well, I didn't even graduate high school, you know, maybe I'm just overextending myself.
Is it because you see all these other kids that kind of, they're younger, and then they're like, oh, I went to such and such school, and then, you know, I'm here, and then they kind of lollygag, and you're like, I got to finish this project for our class thing, because I got to go pick up my son from daycare or whatever.
Yep. I mean, there were a lot of things, you know. I mean, I had to study for tests while I was doing homework with my son, because by that time he was in school himself, so he wasn't a baby. And it was definitely challenging, but I was fortunate. You know, I met a lot of people in school, particularly some members of Alpha Phi Alpha Fraternity Incorporated, an organization I eventually joined. Who encouraged me to keep going, you know, encouraged me to stay in school and keep on track. And eventually I graduated with a degree in journalism. I made the dean's list. I got to study abroad for a summer in Mexico, which was something I never thought I would do. And I even interned for the United States Congress in Washington, D.C., and that was really just an amazing experience. I was there the year that Barack Obama was going against Hillary Clinton in the primary, so I was there during that time, and it was just a really fun time to be in D.C.
That's the craziest time to be there.
And I lived in I lived in dorms with a lot of other people from, like, all over the country, and a lot of other minority students that I never, you know, really experienced. Just all these people who are, you know, young folks, you know. A lot of them were minorities, so they looked like me, and a lot of them were politically involved, and a lot of them liked journalism and all these different things. And it was just such a great experience for me that it really just kind of sparked my ambition as far as what I could become. Then 2009, I graduated with a degree in journalism. Took me about 3 months, but I finally got a job. Somebody finally gave me a job after it was my third interview. And I'll tell you about my first interview, which will be a very interesting story.
Okay.
So in journalism, you to get jobs, instead of turning in a TV journalism, at least, to get jobs, instead of turning in a paper resume, you turn in a resume reel, like a video of you doing reports.
Like sizzles of kind of different things.
Yeah, so I did some reports in college that I had recorded as a part of my program. And one report was on a black barbershop that had been in business for like 25 years, and they survived the downturn in the economy, because if you remember back then in, you know, 2008 or so, the economy wasn't going that well, but they were doing well. And then another story.
The barbershop always does well. But that's
I don't know what they were doing behind the
scenes. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You know, it's always.
They might have been hustling.
They always got listeners, and they always got a little something else going on. Yeah.
That wasn't part of my story, though. But my second story was about the first black state representative in a particular area of Minnesota. And then the third story was about some cheerleaders at my school. And so two stories were about black people, basically the characters in the story, and one story was about some cheerleaders, which was, you know, more of a diverse
general
story. And I turned that into a station, and I went in for my interview, and during my interview, one of the people who was asking me questions asked me if I only knew how to do stories about black people. During my interview, I didn't get that job.
What city was it in?
I won't even say what city.
Oh, you don't even
very,
say what city.
It was a very small town in Minnesota.
Okay, I'll so say. it wasn't you. It's, of course,
no,
it wasn't Cosmopolitan.
It was, no, it was a small town in Minnesota where there weren't a lot of minorities.
Is it Brainerd? No. I've been to Brainerd before.
Where there weren't a lot of minorities, and you know, the interview went downhill from there.
I mean, are you just like?
Well, I was shocked because, you know, obviously there was another story on the reel that didn't include black people. But even if all the stories were about black people, that wasn't the point of the stories. There would never be anything that would bar someone from being able to tell stories about a particular race
of people.
That would it's just a ridiculous question to ask. But it was what I was asked during the interview. And like I said, I didn't get that job, but I got my third job in Alexandria, Minnesota, another small town in Minnesota. But that was a great experience. I worked with great people there. I was there for a year, and then I went to Dayton, Ohio.
What is it? Where's Alexandria, Minnesota? Some
it's
people don't know.
Northern Minnesota. It's maybe about 2 hours north of Minneapolis.
Okay. So it is towards Brainerd.
Oh, yeah.
And it's close to Brainerd.
And it's the country. We did a lot of stories about farms and stuff like that. I did a lot of stories about white people.
Yeah.
I proved that I could do it.
Stories on white people, yeah.
And then I moved to Dayton, Ohio.
Dayton family.
And I was there for 2 years. That was a great experience, too. I almost compare Dayton. It's almost like a mini St. Louis.
It
in
is.
A lot of ways.
I've been there late. My grandmother lived in Dayton for 10 years.
Okay.
So I would be in Dayton a lot. Trotwood.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what I'm saying. She lived off Main Street, so that's like down that way. So like the downtown was like it was the funniest downtown because it was like four blocks.
Yeah.
It felt like it was like the university, a couple of restaurants, and you out. Like you back at the 75 or 85 right there. It's basically you right back at it.
Yep. Definitely Dayton is a small town. But yeah, I had fun there.
Eight Balls, you've been to Eight Balls? Did you ever go to Eight Balls?
No.
And Trotwood? Oh, you never had their wings? The barbecue wings? Oh, man. All my Dayton people know about it's called Eight Balls.
I'm going to have to ask somebody.
It was off Main Street. Whenever Main Street, you know what? You know when you come into Dayton, when you come in that back way through Trotwood where the Best Buy is?
Okay, yeah.
And it's a street right there going through Trotwood. It might be Main Street, but it changed into something else. It's on there going down a little bit. It's across from a barbershop. I remember I got a haircut at before. But Eight Balls, man. Some of the best wings, man.
I'm going to remember that because I get back there every now and then. I go back to Dayton to visit. But I was there for 2 years, and then I moved to St. Louis. It's funny. About 6 months after I was here, I met my wife, and I actually met her right here at Lucas Park.
Really?
Where we're broadcasting from. I met her here.
So is she from St. Louis?
She's from Alton, so.
Okay.
St. Louis.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Anybody who doesn't know where Alton is.
Yeah. St. Louis people know Alton is. It's Alton.
So I met her here, and, you know, I've been here for a while and, you know, acclimated myself to St. Louis. It's kind of become a home for me, even though I'm originally from Minneapolis. This is the place where I've been the longest, other than Minneapolis, and the longest during my adult life.
Years, like the real years.
Yeah, because I've bounced around so many times. So this has definitely become, you know, a home for me.
So coming from Minneapolis, because one of my buddies from high school, he moved to Minneapolis after undergrad to be an engineer. And then he said it was the most diverse place he's ever been to in his life. And also, and I know a little bit of being diverse, but it's different being living there. And also, they have the cleanest streets, I'll also say. Literally, you can eat off those streets in Minneapolis. I tell people that all the time. You can eat off the streets there. But how was that cultural change for you being in Minneapolis where it's kind of – and he says it's kind of a fake multiculturalism some ways because they're championing for the fact that it's kind of multicultural, but it's really kind of not – especially with the situation going with the brother got killed by the police there in Minneapolis. He was like, oh, I told you how it goes down up here, you know, on another side.
You know, I think one thing that helped me is I kind of had a little bit of an introduction because, like I said, in a lot of ways, Dayton is a mini St. Louis. And what I've experienced with Dayton and St. Louis is a lot of self-segregation, I guess, is what I would call it.
Wow, that's interesting. Okay.
Where, particularly among blacks and whites, that there's not a lot of interaction out in social settings, you know, whether it be from what high school folks went to or what college they went to or the circles that they hang around in. It just seems to be a little more segregated in terms of
Is that a Midwest thing, though, more in general?
You know,
it feels like that.
It might be a Midwest thing, but Minneapolis is the outlier.
Yeah, when you're talking about the Midwest in general, yeah, Minneapolis is the outlier.
Because when I lived there, I was used to seeing, you know, more mixed couples,
yeah,
more,
you're not gonna
you
see
know,
that in Chicago,
mixed friends,
Louis,
you know,
Kansas
people.
City.
Yeah, it just
I
was
always
more...
liked that too. I feel like I always liked the Des Moines, and because I went to school at Iowa State, so all that was similar. But it was weird because it was similar like that, but it was also very segregated as well. Because basically, I went to St. Louis University High here in St. Louis, all boys prep school.
Okay,
you know, like I know more white friends from high school than I do college, because we were so insulated as a black community at Iowa State. I can just literally hang with black people all day besides class, and that's all I know. Like, if you go to my Facebook page, that's all the Iowa State people, 90%. And no, actually, no, the ones that are white now are ones I've met from the Alumni Association, and we got cool as adults, not because we were cool at undergrad. It's people like, oh, yeah, we were in the same class together. I'm like, don't even remember you, man. Like, it's people in journalism class that remember me, like, yeah, man, you did all this. They're like, don't remember you, man. Cause you, it was all, yeah, and I was back then. I was almost halfway Rastafari, and I had dreads. I had the whole demo going on. It was waiting for the revolution every day. Waiting for, and then looking back, I'm like, I'm in Iowa, man, dude. Like, it's way more racially diverse. Why was we waiting for the revolution there? Like, everybody was super cool.
That,
like,
that was ground zero.
Yeah, we was like, it was gonna pop off right here in Ames, Iowa. It was on, you know. But it was so they were great people to me, though. Like, looking mm-hmm. back, like, you'd be like, damn, like, they were good ass people to me. Even when I go back, like, oh man, blah blah blah, I'm like,
yeah.
And that's when being back in St. Louis is when I was like, well, shit, like,
yeah,
like,
it's definitely different. You know, I don't know what, you know, fuels that in St. Louis. It's just kind of a different kind of thing. But in general, I don't think it's like a negative thing where black people and white people don't want to hang out with each other per se. It's just, it just ends up happening that way for whatever reason, and you know, it's unfortunate.
I mean,
but
St. Louis got redlined a lot historically. I don't know if you know that historically. Like, so basically, how Normandy and all these cities, mm-hmm. like these, they were all white. That's almost like Normandy. People can look at Normandy, your Hazelwoods and all that. Like, you can, like, there Hazelwood Central. You know, high school Hazelwood Central.
Yeah,
that was, and my fiance went there. It was 60% white when she was there, and she graduated in the early 2000s.
Wow.
And I remember in the early 90s, you go there, 91, 92, it was mostly white people. So what happened was a black family would move in some areas, right? We know the story, but there was real estate agents pushing that up too, though, because St. Charles was trying to blow up.
So they were getting people out there.
I guarantee you, go ask anyone that's from St. Charles, ask them where they originally came from, St. Charles, St. Peter's, O'Fallon. Where's your family coming before here? I guarantee all of them say North County.
It's
a direct. St. Charles benefited historically on black people moving to North County in that white flight. Like, it's a direct. It's you can directly correlate it between that. You could ask them, where'd you? Oh no, we lived in Normandy until '93, or we lived in Hazelwood until '97, '98, and it's net. And real estate agents kind of pushed that, like, well, you know, with some nicer houses out here, you could sell your house and you got 5%, I mean, you know, 5,000 extra equity in there, it'd be better for you. I mean, I'm just saying, you look around, look around you, there's two black families in the neighborhood now.
Hint, hint.
Hint, hint, hint. Or just saying, you know, or they may not say that, but like my lady says, she'll say that, said, some different people are moving in, you know, I don't know if you how you feel about that, you know. And that's how would fuel that whole kind of St. Charles thing. Even deeper though, people that from St. Louis know how MetroLink was stopped to go out there.
Oh yeah,
yeah. They voted against it, saying they didn't want the inner city element out there in St. Charles. Like, you're gonna ride the train all the way out to St. Charles, put that flat screen, get this flat screen from the neighborhood all the way back. You didn't drive out there
just to go out there to commit a crime.
Yeah, no, it's still a flat screen. Get it back on the MetroLink. Ride the MetroLink all the way back to East St. Louis.
Yeah, I don't know what that's about.
Same thing with 170. The highway 170 was all the way go through to 44.
Okay.
Same thing. They didn't want that element being able to traffic go down that way. That's why 170 doesn't connect all the way to 44.
Yeah.
That inner belt was supposed to go all the way through to 55.
Yeah, it's interesting how St. Louis has evolved, you know, over the years, and you know, just in the short time that I've been here, you know, since what, 2012 was when I first.
So, what is
moved
your perspective on being here as a reporter, seeing things happen in St. Louis? That's kind of, you know, put another place.
You know,
because I know we talked before, and you were like, "Man, I'm just tired of seeing all this
stuff
happen."
It's frustrating, you know. I mean, I think a lot of times people think that journalists don't care or they are looking for the negativity, because when you turn on the news, a lot of times that's what you see. But the reality is that our research tells us that that's what people want to see. They want to watch that for whatever reason, even when they scream out loud that they don't want to watch that, that's what they end up tuning in for. And at the end of the day, it's a business, journalism, TV journalism. We have to get people to watch so that we can influence advertisers to pay us to run their commercials, and that's how I get my salary. Right. So that's how it all, you know, kind of works. And, you know, it's not that we really want to cover those stories, but they just tend to keep happening. And, you know, especially in St. Louis, for whatever reason, the murders obviously are just out of control, and it's frustrating. You know, I have my cell phone alerts on my phone, you know, when there's certain news that comes across, and it's literally like I can't go a day without getting an alert saying so-and-so shot in this part of the town or this area, you know, and it's just, it's frustrating, you know. I mean, I hate seeing it over and over and over again, you know, and I hate doing those stories where we keep having these people who are suspects or whoever, you know, a lot of people who I look at and I say that they were me. I was just like them at one point in my life, but for whatever reason, I was able to, you know, one, be lucky enough that nothing really bad happened to me along the way, and that I didn't make that one crucial mistake, and then also that I kind of got my mind together in time.
Did you have a mentor or anything that kind of helped? Like, were you like, man, like this person kind of pulled me? Like, I, before we got on, I talked about my professor, Dr. Isaiah Pia, and he basically helped me all the way through college.
You know, I had my sister's boyfriend, my older sister's boyfriend, who, in a lot of ways, I would consider him my father. He was around. Okay. He was around in my life. He was her boyfriend when I was like 5 and 6, you know, and okay. They're still together. They're still together now.
So how far age are you all different then? Your sister.
My sister, who he is with, she is in her 40s, so she was probably like around maybe 16 when they got together.
Okay.
And so I was maybe like about 5 or so.
Oh, so you guys are like 11 years apart.
Yeah, we have a big spread. Gap. Yeah, we have a okay. big gap. And so he's been around that long in my life, and he was a mentor in the fact that he would help me do whatever I wanted to do. What I mean by that is that
either good or bad.
Exactly. What I mean by
whatever
like
direction
that,
you wanted to go in, he
had my back when I wasn't making the smart choices, but then when I did want to make the smart choices, he had my back through all of that and would guide me through all of those things too. And then when I made wrong choices, he would tell me what was right, but at the same time, he had a little bit of a checkered past himself, so he wasn't judgmental, and he kind of understood the situation that I was coming from. So he was a mentor in that aspect, where, you know, whatever I wanted to do, he was going to be my cheerleader.
Yeah, and, I'm down. You know, I got you.
For the last, I'm 35 now, so for the last 20 years or so, or well, let me say 18 years or so of my life, I've been making smart choices. He's been my biggest cheerleader. So
really, well, okay, that's interesting. Dynamic with it, where it's like your sister's boyfriend is like, yeah, I got your back. If you want to go over there now, you know, I'll drop you off.
Yeah, it's pretty much.
But it's gonna be. Does he tell you that it's gonna be some consequences for this, or is he like,
oh yeah,
so he's not like,
oh yeah, no,
he's not
he would
riding
say,
shotgun with
no,
you.
No, he would say you're playing with fire. He'll tell you, but he's not gonna
be like, you know what?
Yeah,
you know, like
he understands the game and understands, you know, the way that
things kind of play out.
Things play out in the way that my life had played out. So he understood some of the circumstances that I found myself in with being a young father, with not having my father around, you know, with growing up in a relatively poor household, you know, with growing up in an area where a lot of people dropped out of high school, where a lot of people had children as a teenager, where a lot of people were ending up in jail and prison. He understood all those things and, you know, tried to guide me through that to avoid some of the mistakes, but you know, at the end of the day, he had my back no matter what I decided.
Is he from Minneapolis?
He's actually from Iowa.
What Iowa is he from?
You know, I don't know what city in Iowa he's from, but he was born there, but they moved to Minneapolis when he was really young.
Okay.
But his father,
I wonder if he's from like Waterloo or something, one of those.
Because
black
when
towns,
his when his father passed away, they went back there and had a big huge funeral somewhere in Iowa. So yeah, but he's an Iowa guy.
Wow. But people sleep on Iowa, man. Oh, yeah. It's as people say, man, everybody's the man in their own hood. You go to somebody else's place, it's somebody that's a big dog wherever you go. I remember one time I was in Tucumare, New Mexico. Like I told you before, I did event marketing, so I had to travel.
Okay.
Like literally, like 2 years I traveled for nonstop. So I've been to every little podunk place or drove through it. Tucumare, New Mexico. It's basically, to give y'all geographically where it is, it's 2 hours east of Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Okay.
So this is really not literally, it's not even mountains yet. Like, it's like kind of the lowlands areas of New Mexico in between Amarillo, so up in that panhandle, West Texas kind of vibe that is there. Man, you'd be surprised who you see out in those places, man. you would be surprised who you see. A lot of my friends that know me know the story where I got trapped at a Mexican party drunk, and it was tripping. It was bad. I've got a lot of bad places I've been. My lady always told me, like, I was meant to do so much more because I put myself in so many bad situations.
Just dumb.
Why would I be at this party and then talking noise to people? Like, why would you do that? But even moving forward, so how old is your son and everything?
My son is 17 now.
So how is that dynamic, though? Cause
it's weird. He you know, he's getting close to being a grown man himself. His name is Anthony also. You know, he's just like me. He's exactly how I was when I was his age, with a lot of his mentality and a lot of, you know, even some of the decisions that he's made. You know, fortunately, he has a little bit more of a better support system. You know, obviously, he has me, you know, his mother, my mother, who's a big influence in his life, and the other people in our family. But it's just a different generation. It's so weird because I know that a lot of his attitude is exactly how I behaved then. Mm-hmm. But it's so frustrating for me.
And it's like, upsetting. You don't see what happens.
Didn't
I tell you my story?
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
Does he live in Minneapolis still?
Yeah, he lives in Minneapolis, and that's another thing that makes the dynamic a little difficult because, you know, I don't get to see him as often as I would like. And, of course, he's at that age where he's not really too interested in hanging out with parents or adults. He wants to be with his friends and his little girlfriends or whatever, you know, so... He'll come back around
mid-20s. It comes all the way back around.
And it's so funny. You know, my father right now, he lives in a nursing home. And, you know, I didn't get into this today yet, but in the article that I wrote, I talked a little bit about it, that he had suffered from mental illness for most of his life. Memory loss, things like that, like specific things. Like, he knows I'm his son, but he doesn't know which one of his sons I am. Things like that. So... Okay.
So he confuses you all.
Yeah,
so
but he knows I'm his son. If he sees me, he just doesn't know which one, and you know, that kind of thing. But it's interesting because at 35 is when I wish I had him around more than even when I was younger. You know, as a 35-year-old married man, you know.
Yeah, just trying to navigate this system.
This is really where I wish, you know, I could call up my dad and say, you know, Pops, you know, what's going on.
That's how I feel too,
but,
man.
You know,
I feel the same way.
It's not that kind of, you know, dynamic just because of his health that, you know, he can't really have those kind of conversations with me. So, you know, I'm hoping that as my son gets older, you know, that I can be around to have those conversations with him, you know, because you really never stop needing that, you know. You don't stop when you're 18, all of a sudden you don't need any advice, especially
when
you're a man. Like,
you need the most.
I don't know what it is, but it's like, you know, as a man in this world trying to navigate your way through it, you really need that guidance throughout your whole life. And if you don't get it from one person, hopefully you're smart enough or you're fortunate enough to have other people in your life that you can. You know, I've been fortunate, you know, that I have, you know, a Rolodex or cell phone full of black males, you know, who are from my age all the way up to 60 who, you know, I can call and get advice from and who are more than willing to, you know, help me out. And they understand my perspective, the things that I've gone through in life, and, you know, they can help.
So I guess being a father is a whole another different dynamic, but how does that work, I guess, within your relationship, within your marriage as well? I don't know, do you all have kids, you and your wife together?
We don't have kids together. My wife didn't have any children when I met her, so that was kind of an interesting kind of melding for both of us. You know, both of us are 35. So when we got married, or
was
when
she
we
a cheerleader
were,
for Alton back in the day?
Yep.
Oh man, we played football against them back in the day when I was.
Oh
a
man,
freshman.
She, yeah, she was a cheerleader for Alton, and she was.
We almost had a fight with her. Was she the one black?
She probably was the black, you know, no, one.
We may need to talk off air just because that's another thing, though. But when I was a freshman, we played Alton, and I don't know, for some reason it was like. It was only three black guys on our team, and I'm like, but y'all got more black people, but they call them as niggas though. But I'm like, and we looking at the other black dudes like, huh, y'all just gonna let
y'all
this
hear your
ride?
Do you hear your teammates?
Yeah, yeah, like you gonna let this ride? So I mean, I'm one of those people that you know, So it got a little. So I remember it was one black girl from Alton's cheerleading team freshman year.
We'll have to take that conversation off air, but I bet it was her. Yeah, she was a cheerleader there for a couple years. And then she cheerleaded in college at Missouri Valley College. Where she
okay,
went.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, one of the first things that I did when we were dating, at least as far as taking the next step, is I took her back home to Minnesota and she met my son.
Did you take her in the winter?
You know, I did take her when it was cold.
You
I took
to.
Her in like
you had
November.
To give her a real. You ain't got to give her a real.
It was a mistake because now that was when she said, "I don't ever need to go back," because it was like November. And at that time, it was for whatever reason, it was warm in St. Louis, and we went back there, and it was freezing cold. And
but that's
like,
the real Minneapolis.
Yeah,
though.
And she's like, "It's like this in November," so she wasn't.
I know how
this
is gonna be in January,
yeah.
or February.
but she went back there and met my son, and you know the rest of my family. She had already met my mother before that, but you know that introduction was that step. That was almost like the final step I needed before I could propose to her.
To meet your son.
Just to meet my son. Not that he needed to approve for it, but just so that I could at least say, you know, my son's met my fiance.
Yeah, you right.
Know?
You're just going to be popping up. Yeah. Hey, this is going to be your new mama. You know, you know, respect her, you know.
Yeah, so that was an interesting thing. You know, one good thing about my wife is, you know, she's very considerate of my son and as far as, you know, making sure that he's included and stuff, and that I'm thinking about him. Like, she's the kind of wife who, did you call your son? He called Anthony.
Right, because we forget
that
about
kind
that
of
stuff.
Yeah.
And it's not even personal, though.
Yeah.
Like, I had to lose that as my own dad, though, and everything. My dad, he'll just text me, and now, like, it's almost like I'm repeating what he did to me. Like, I won't text him back for, like, 2 days. Like, I forget, and then Lexi will be like, did you talk to your dad? He sent you a car. Like, oh, yeah, I got the car, pops. My bad. What's up?
Yeah,
you know. So but we forget stuff.
Yeah,
you know.
So yeah, now that's what happens, and that's why it's you know, good to have a good woman in
your
corner who will
tell
do those
time,
kind of
man.
Things. So yeah, it's been a good situation, you know. And I don't at this point have like baby mama drama or
that's
anything
what I was,
like
okay,
that.
Okay, that was what I was going to go into next. So how was that dynamic being like?
I was fortunate that by the time I had met my wife and we started to get serious, I was far removed from being with my son's mother.
So it's like
several years. So yeah. And she had been in a serious relationship for a number of years too, while I was single. So you know, it wasn't like a breakup and then I'm with this
you're
other woman
the
and then I'm getting
person.
Married.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate in that aspect, and then just living a few states away.
Yeah, the
you know,
separation.
Even
like,
if you got a good relationship, sometimes that could be a difficult thing to
navigate
to
a little
with.
Bit, though.
Yeah,
yeah,
so,
yeah. I agree.
So
I
yeah,
agree.
I was you know, fortunate about that.
So how do you feel about your son's future plan? Like, do you have like that track? You know, some people have that thing like, this is what we need to do. And these,
yeah,
these
you know, for my son right now, you know, he's similar, like I said, to how I was when I was that age. He's not too hot on the idea of school. So I'm actually trying to encourage him to go to the Navy. That's actually
at least get some kind of structure and do something.
Because I don't want him to waste years after high school just kind of sitting around doing nothing or you know, possibly getting into trouble and that sort of thing. And I also think that'll set him up for something really positive in the future while he doesn't necessarily know what he wants to do right now. I mean, I think it'll be an opportunity for him to, you know, travel the world, you know, serve his country and serve in one of the relatively safer branches. Like, I wouldn't be encouraging him to be a Marine.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of
Army or
yeah, nothing wrong with that. It's just, you know, I'd be scared for my son. And I know folks in the Navy are at risk also, but from
the
outside.
When the last time a tanker been hit, though? Ain't the last time the USS
from
Roosevelt has not
been
hit?
From the outside, it seems like one of the more safe branches of the military. So, and it's something that I thought about doing when I was younger. Like when I was in the process of after getting my GED and thinking about college, I thought about that too. Like I didn't think about going to the Army or any of those things because, you know, I was scared. But I thought, okay, you know, let me look at the Navy. And I mean, I even remember going to a recruiter and talking with them. And so that's one direction that I plan on encouraging him to go toward. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's up to him. I just want him to, you know, do positive things, you know, make smart choices, smarter than the choices that I made, you know, and you know, live out whatever his dream is.
Okay. So, like, going forward, I guess, what is your future plans now? Going forward, like, you know, this is what kind of my building blocks and where I kind of want to move,
sure.
Move my movement.
Well, I've been a television reporter / anchor for 7 years. It'll be 7 years in October. So I'm kind of at a little bit of a crossroads, I think, in my career. I know that I've always...
You got the career midlife crisis.
Oh, yeah. I've always thought about teaching at the university level, not necessarily sure if I would teach journalism or something related to politics, which I've always been interested in, or something related to law. Either of those courses are probably going to require me to go back to school. So I think that's probably going to be my next move. Grad school, law school, possibly. Those are the things that I'm looking into now. And, you know, I may continue my journalism career. I may not. It just kind of depends on how things shake out. You know, I've enjoyed it. I've had a, you know, amazing experience and been able to cover some amazing stories and meet a lot of amazing people and do things that I never thought I would do. You know, when I graduated with a degree in journalism, I wasn't the kid in my class that people said that guy's going to be reporting in St. Louis. He's going to be a, you know, successful news anchor.
What
reporter.
Do you think? He's
going to
be a world star? Like they thought the world, I don't know the world what, star reporter. Like
I don't know what they thought I was going to be.
The GGN network.
But I wasn't that guy in my class. And it's weird because I'm probably of my graduating class who were in that specific program. They're probably like maybe 16 kids. Mm-hmm. I may be the only kid right now
in a major market.
Definitely in a major market, but there may only be like one or two who are even in journalism anymore. Like all the rest did it for maybe a year or two and then left. They did something else, or, you know, maybe they couldn't find a job and just gave up right away. But, you know, I was fortunate in the fact that, you know, it was something I dreamed about doing, that I wanted to do, and I actually got an opportunity to do it. So I've lived that dream. The question is just kind of what's the next dream for me?
So my next question, what would be the best journalistic setup for you? Like, man, I'm going to stay here. Is it the CNN, the MSNBC, or is it the magazine style, like the Brian Gumbel Real Sports, which I think is, to me personally, that's the best style of journalism, is where you can go out, cover this story for 2 months, follow this person, you know, and just kind of, and then come and bring it back, and that's all you got to kind of roll with.
Yeah, I mean, that would be a dream because, you know, in my situation, you know, I get to work at about 3 a.m., I got like several notes on stories, you know, of emails of information, and I got about an hour to kind of get everything together. I got to find my video. I got to listen to interviews and pick out what interviews I'm going to use. I got to write my story. I got to get to an area for my live shot.
But that's changed though within media. With the media, that's downsizing the media though. Because you had somebody that did all that. Before, they would just slide you the copy of what you were supposed to be saying.
Yeah, well, you had other people who did a lot of those things for you, and then a lot of times you just had more time because there were more people to do your job. So it wasn't necessary to have me on TV in 1 hour because we had three other reporters who were working different stories, and they were going to be on, and they've been working different shifts. But now everything is so downsized, and everything is in the situation where one person is doing three jobs and that kind of thing. It's just kind of how it works. But
I remember you telling me how you were shooting, and I told you the one day I was back in my old hood, mm-hmm. and I was like, yo, I saw you over by Fairground Park. That's because I grew up in the area and I was visiting my grandmother. And I was like, you was out there by yourself? Like, yeah, I got to do everything. I got to run the camera. I got to shoot the story, and I damn near got to edit it. I was like, damn. Are they paying you three checks? Because that's three different checks.
You know, and that's one of the things about TV, that they don't pay you for that because it's kind of the benefit of being on television. That's a little bit what I talked to you about earlier, that for a lot of people is almost a form of payment. It doesn't reflect in your check, but if you were to talk with news managers,
that's
almost like with rolled in with your compensation. And, you know, I don't look at it that way. Like, no, yeah. I just look at the number
right,
on the check.
I'm
like,
trying to see where
I don't care about being on television.
Is my 401k messed up
check.
In this Brixen thing or what?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's kind of an interesting dynamic for it. But for me, I think the always or the dream that I always thought about would be the coolest, like, reporting TV job would be like in the White House press corps. Mm. That would be like a dream thing for me, where I'm sitting in there.
So you want
and
to
I'm,
be like, what is it, a House of Cards? You want to be yeah. like House of Cards? You want to be House
and I'm in there asking the president questions and just strictly covering politics in Washington, D.C. That would be probably a dream kind of job for me in journalism. You know, I also like some of those reporters who get to, you know, travel internationally and do stories. That's always cool to me, too. And that diversity in stories that they get to cover, you know, because a lot of times in local TV specifically, you know, you get stuck covering a lot of similar stories. You get stuck covering a lot of crime. You get stuck covering, you know, a lot of city drama and things like that. But particularly crime, especially in St. Louis.
Yeah.
And, you know, like I mentioned
I would challenge
before,
you to actually ask some of those people that's been there 23. Ask them, is this worse than the early 90s? Remember we talked about Black Man Speak. I was like, ask somebody about the early 90s in St. Louis. And I would just want to just see if that more of a just heightened thing because we have more media. Or is it like, man, like, because the early 90s, at least me living in North St. Louis, and I'm detached. I live in Creve Coeur, so I'm away from, but it feels like when I go back, you know, my lady's all scared because our daughter goes to daycare in the city, and I'm like, this ain't as bad as the early 90s. And maybe I'm the one that's just used to knowing where to be at and how to drive around and move, but I feel like, because they statistically crime is down, but then on the other side, on the converse, it's statistically down nationwide because other places are lowering their crime and the urban areas are staying consistent. So the average has,
you know,
more, you know, I mean, I always try to figure out where that the real baseline of that is. If that makes sense.
In a lot of ways, what has happened is law enforcement just nationwide has figured out ways to keep people who are not involved or at least in close proximity to people who are involved in that kind of life to keep those people out of crime. And I think that's what contributes to some of these numbers.
Yeah,
a lot of the victims tend to be people who live next to the drug dealer or live
right.
next to, you know, people who are making poor decisions. And sometimes the victims are people who are making poor decisions themselves.
Yeah.
But it's not the victim who lives in Creve Coeur,
right.
for example.
Somebody, he was down there hanging out getting a dub, you know, or something like that.
And, hey, you know, I don't know how people keep their numbers, but sometimes, man, they might count a victim in Creve Coeur as two people instead of one.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's this whole, you know, idea that people talk about, the idea of the Black Lives Matter kind of thing, you
right.
know, where does a black life equal that of, you know, a white life? Or, you know, not even necessarily race, does an urban life, does a person who live in poverty, does their life equal the same as someone who, you know, lives in a more financially affluent area? You know, and that's a debate. I don't know how they do their numbers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Chicago was cooking their numbers for a while. Shout out to my boy, Curtis Tarvey. He's a lawyer. He's told me that a long time. He's like, yeah, when you see this after this Olympic thing, because I don't know if you know Chicago, but they've been cooking their numbers for murders for 20 years.
Because
they were trying
the
to get,
cooking
they
the books.
Because they were trying to get the Olympics.
Oh, wow.
So, like, so this explosion of numbers is because of some things, but a lot of it has been happening.
Wow.
It's just that we are visualizing and seeing it. And also there's a lot of gentrification going on with it because they're moving gang members out of the same gangs into the same neighborhoods because they're moving people from here to here, and it's a lot of that going on as well. But we talked about this before. I don't know if you want to expound on it. If you can, we talked about Black Lives Matter. The Ferguson situation, I don't know if you would get this, but like just that experience, you being, you know, the token Negro of the month, as they say, out there for Ferguson, and
yeah.
that experience, and because that was an interesting thing we talked about before.
You know, we talked about it briefly, just kind of what happened with Ferguson is that a lot of news organizations, and I can't speak to the motivation because I'm not in those kind of decision-making meetings, but a lot of news organizations in the St. Louis area and in the surrounding states really put their black reporters out front during Ferguson. They gave them opportunities to be the lead reporter, the reporter on the scene covering the story. You know, when I was covering Ferguson, I was out there every morning. I was a morning reporter then at a different station. And I was every morning live at Ferguson Police Department talking about what had happened overnight. And I was alongside 10, 15, 20 other black
reporters. So y'all all sit with all the tripods along the whole row.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting that just gave us an opportunity to really be out front, but you know, I don't know what the motivation was behind that. I don't know if it was that news organizations across the country felt like black reporters could tell the story better, or if they felt that black reporters would be more comfortable in Ferguson telling the stories, or if they thought that maybe viewers would be more comfortable watching black reporters tell that story. But for whatever reason, and this happened with stations across the country, not just St. Louis, stations from Minnesota, stations from Wisconsin, stations from Kansas, from Arkansas, from Illinois, they all sent their minority reporters to Ferguson. Now, there were some white reporters who came also. You know, of course, there were the Anderson Coopers and people like that. And even some of the local stations sent white reporters there, too. But it really was a just convergence of, like, black reporters. You could ask any black reporter, and they'll tell you.
It was, it was almost
exactly. That's exactly what I was going to say. It was like an impromptu NABJ meeting
or convention in Ferguson.
Because they just, you know, gave us all an opportunity to be out there. And again, I don't know what the motivation was behind that, but we were the ones telling that story out front, telling that story more than any other story I can ever remember. I mean, if you just watch coverage of any other major national story where reporters from across the country converge on one city, you never would see that many black reporters covering a specific story. And another, like the funeral of Michael Brown, I covered that too. And that was another example of that, where it was just, a lot of times we kind of line up. It's almost like a
press row, like a, the red
yeah,
carpet,
like a press, like a press row. And you would, you know, there's reporters 5 feet apart down a row doing their reports. I mean, it was all black folks, you know, and it was just an interesting time and an interesting way that the decision makers in news decided to cover that story. I think it worked out well. I mean, I think that people covered that story pretty accurately and as good as they could. I mean, it was a very difficult story to cover because, you know, you had people on both sides of the issue trying to sway you, and they didn't want reporters to just tell the story. They wanted reporters to be on their side, whether they were a protester or whether they were people who were upset with the protesters. They wanted people to be on their side, the people who were reporting the stories. And that's not our job. Our job isn't to go out there and say that, you know, the protesters are right or the protesters are wrong. It's just to say what was going on and explain what we were seeing, show people video of it, tell people the facts as we knew them at the time. And, you know, that's what I tried to do. For the most part, I think I was able to tell that story well, and you know, I didn't get any negativity, you know, and a lot of people did. A lot of people were attacked on social media, a lot of people were attacked via email, a lot of people were attacked
black or white, or was it
black and white? Black and white. Oh yeah. And then, you know, people on both sides. I mean, like I said, there were people who were invested in that story, and if you weren't on their side, you were the enemy.
And oh, you say from both sides.
From both sides. You know, it wasn't, you know, just protesters who were upset with the media. It wasn't just people who were, you know, against the protesters, or people who felt that the shooting of Michael Brown was justified who were against the media. People on all sides were upset with the media simply because most of them wanted the reporters to go on television and reinforce what they believed about the situation. And that's not our job. Our job isn't to do that. And, you know, I don't think that I saw any instances of reporters doing that. I think that reporters, for the most part, did a pretty good job of just telling the story, you know. And then sometimes people mix up the difference between like reporters and commentators, because of course there were people who were commentators and going out there giving their opinion and saying things about the situation, you know, based on what they thought. But, you know, that's not the same as a reporter. That's not what my job was during that situation.
So you didn't get a lot of backlash you felt when, from your
I didn't. You know, I mean, I got a few questions every now and then on social media about, you know, well, add this to your report or add that, you know, that kind of thing. But nothing really, really negative. I think the only time that it turned negative for me, I had an instance when a Ferguson resident who lived there, he was tired of seeing the media there. He just wanted the media to go. Just in general, he just wanted us to go. He felt like we were continuing the story when we didn't need to be there. We were still there reporting, and he was upset about that.
But that had nothing to do with the actual...
Nothing to do with the actual content of reports. He just didn't want to see news vehicles and news reporters in his community anymore. He had enough.
So even with that, what is your best interview you feel like that you had where you like, or let's say best interview you had and maybe the most, I don't know, more iconic, like where you got the interview, maybe somebody you're like, man, this is kind of cool that I interviewed this person.
Yeah, you know, I think during that time at Michael Brown's funeral, I got to interview, do a live interview with Benjamin Crump, the attorney
for
the family. And that was an interesting interview because, you know, at that point, you know, I mean, obviously, his funeral was huge. There were thousands of people there, you know, a lot of celebrities there, and he stepped out, you know, to take a moment to talk with me, and we talked a little bit about, you know, just the idea of what was going on in the country specifically at that time, just this idea of using deadly force against people who are unarmed, period, that in itself, and, you know, he gave some really profound thoughts, you know, regarding that, and of course, you know, he's been at the forefront of a lot of these things. Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown. He's almost like the go-to attorney.
I don't know how that happened either.
I don't know either.
I don't even know. Like, I need to. Like, I keep on telling myself I need to Google him and just to research him and all. I'm like, he just pops up everywhere. Like, he's there.
You know, I think what happens is you do one of those high-profile stories, and then you just become the guy.
Oh, I remember Johnny
that
Cochran
guy.
Back
yeah,
in the day.
I remember that guy. He's the guy who we need to call. And, you know... He's a person who a lot of people question whether he was good on television, but he was a person who could attract the television cameras. So, and a lot of the story, you know, these stories are about that. You know, I mean, it's decided in the courtroom, but, you know, public opinion is a powerful thing, you know, very powerful. I mean, a lot of people forget that, you know, especially with the Trayvon Martin thing. That thing had died down, and it was almost a done deal. But then public opinion started to sway, and there were protests, and there were news interviews. And then all of a sudden, you end up with a trial.
And, that trial was not going to happen.
It didn't appear that it was heading that way at all. It seemed like it was a done deal. So, you know, that's one of the situations that kind of shows how important public opinion is, and he's been able to attract you know, that attention and sway public opinion, you know, whether you agree with them or not.
It's about George Zimmerman?
No, Benjamin Crump.
Oh, I'll call him Ho Zimmerman.
Zimmerman. I don't even want to talk about that man. Oh, my God.
I mean, even, I don't know if you can get a tangent, but I don't know, do people, nobody's ever has, I wonder if somebody did a story on going back to people that were defending him, like kind of like an expose. I tweeted Brian Gumbel about it though. Like, hey, I know this is not sports related. I don't know how you can relate to sports, but I need you to try to figure out because you do. He did because to me, or someone needs to do a 30 for 30. All it seems like all the best documentaries right now are like the sports ones. ESPN are like your Brian Gumbel Real Sports. I'm like, go back and re-interview those same people and see how they feel about, you know, that guy again. Though, like, kind of an expose, like kind of like documentary style, or like. You felt like this before, but now how do you feel?
You know,
about this?
I don't know how publicized it was, but I do recall seeing an interview with a white man, and I believe that something happened in his personal life. I think that maybe he had a son who, after the trial, had died or had been killed or something like that, and he had an interview, and he did admit that he regretted a not guilty vote in that case. And he was a white man who, you know, felt that, you know, at that time it was a different situation, but I guess after experiencing the loss of his own son and then seeing some
from
of the
from a stand your ground situation.
No, it wasn't stand your
general,
ground.
He lost
but
his
he
son.
Lost his son, and that was part of the interview that he talked about that had an impact on him, but also some of the antics of George Zimmerman after the fact changed his viewpoint, and you know, he admitted that he regretted voting that way. So there's one, but I don't know how publicized it was, and I don't think that there have been a lot of significant interviews.
I wonder if there is someone that's doing a documentary on that now. Like,
well, and then I'd imagine a lot of those people want to remain anonymous. They don't want people to know
no,
who they are.
How they felt before. Or let's go through social media and go through your timeline and be like, hey, you were kind of whole profile and you were supporting this. How do you feel now, you know, about this individual? You know, like, you know, you probably won't respond. It's fine, you know, but at least it's on the record, you know. Because
yeah.
That's the thing, though. So going into my rapid-fire questions, but one, all what right. did you think about, and this is something that just popped in my head before we came here. It wasn't in my notes to ask you this, but I don't know how I'm going to construct this because it's kind of a new thing, though. The Jesse Williams speech from BET Awards, did you get a chance to see that?
Yeah.
What did you think about that, especially you being a biracial black male?
Yeah.
You know, and so, and I'm going to make this a compound question, so it's going to probably be like a five-minute response because it's not going to compound it for you. I'm just not going to give you just the question of like what you feel about it. There's three different levels of, because I'm going to give you three different sides of the question. How do you feel about that towards the general mainstream society, of how they felt? Then the other side of it, where people were saying, and this may be fringe, but it's still out there shouting of him being, because he's a biracial male, him being able to have that avenue of that biracial privilege upon that as well. So the kind of...
Oh, okay. So
I know it's a real, I know that's
yeah.
a real compact
no, it's,
question.
It,
yeah.
It's interesting. You know, I don't know what his background was growing up, but I have a mixed sister. I also have a sister who's all the way white. So
is that a younger sister?
Older sister. My
the,
eldest,
your oldest
my
sister
eldest,
you were talking
my
about
eldest
with the boyfriend.
Sister with the boyfriend. She's all the way white.
Okay.
Okay. So I had a black woman who was in my house, my sister, or a biracial woman.
Yeah.
But then I also had a white woman. I also had my mother. And then I've grown up in communities where there were a lot of black women. And then, obviously, I was raised by black men. There were no white men around in my life when I was growing up. So I don't know what his dynamic was, but I think when you grow up that way as a biracial man, you tend to, for whatever reason, identify more as a black man. It just happens that way. And I think, in general,
society forces you in a box.
And I'll tell you exactly why. This is an example. Every single interview that I've ever had as an adult in media, during those interviews, somehow during that time, the idea of me being black came up. And it came up from the people across from me. It would be maybe a reference saying, you know, we really believe in diversity here. You know, we, you know, like
so
the fact
very,
that you're...
So it's very, very undercut.
That's, we, well, they'll just... say, you know, we believe in diversity, you know, we, and I don't want to use, this might be just paraphrasing, but, you know, we hire black men, we put them in leadership positions, that kind of thing. That's the kind of thing that I've heard in every single interview that I've ever had, without me ever telling them I'm a black man, or without me ever...
Because you could be Hispanic,
or without,
you could be Dominican,
or without,
you could be... Yeah.
Or without me ever... having any, there's nothing in my resume that identifies me as a black man. There's nothing. There's no way for them to know that other than them looking at me and talking with me. And these have all been white people. Mm. So for whatever reason, they have identified me that way. They have told me that you're a black man in my eyes. And I think for all of my life, it's been that way. And I would probably guess that it's probably been that same way for Jesse. Now, he may have some sort of privilege in different circles, being a lighter man. Sometimes people think that's less threatening, that kind of thing. We know that's
a
study.
Yeah,
it's scientific.
Yeah,
it's you know, people have studied that. So he may have that benefit, but it doesn't mean that he doesn't still face the same racism. But the biggest thing that I would say, it doesn't mean that he doesn't face the same pain in some of the things that we see. And that's what I heard.
His wife is a brown skin, lighter brown woman.
And that's what I heard in that speech and in all the other things I've ever heard him say in regards to, you know, some of the things that we've seen, you know, with officer-involved shootings and that kind of thing. You can see that it hurts him. So whether he's biracial or even if he's a white man, whatever's going on hurts him and he gets upset about it. So I would never have an issue with him talking about it. I don't think anyone should. Then just in terms of what he said, the other thing that I would point out is that people may say that he's privileged, but he has probably lost millions of dollars in acting roles as a result
of him. Like Harry Belafonte, that's why they should do a comparison. Yeah.
As a result of him being so outspoken, because think about it. He's a good actor. I've seen him on Grey's Anatomy. Yeah. He seems like a good actor. What else have you ever seen him in? How many other roles?
Cabin in the Woods, that was it. That's where I first saw him, it was in Cabin in the Woods.
But for him to play such a major role in that show, you would think that he would get more opportunities in movies or other things, and you just really don't see him. You don't see him out there as like this male, you know, acting star that I think he probably could be.
I think it's somebody hit the tap that market of him to be an attractive dude. Girls like him. You need to hit that oil pal, and it's sitting there with all the women ready to sit in the theater to see him be the next light-skinned Idris Elba, basically.
I think that there would have been the opportunity for that, but I think that he's so outspoken, that speech and some of the other things that he said, I think that executives are probably terrified of him. They probably don't want to put him in that position.
They don't want him to be at a press junket and he's not talking about the movie, talking about Mike Brown being
because
killed.
He'll speak out. And that's the other reason why you have to give him credit, whether you agree with what he said or not. He's sacrificing, like, in real life to say that. Like, that's going to cost him. Like, that's not like he didn't just say that speech and then he can go back and nothing. There's no repercussions for him. There's going to be repercussions for him. It might not be where he's going to get fired or, you know, where he, you know, will get hurt or anything like that. But there's going to be that executive that maybe had an opportunity for him. And then they're going to say, I don't know. They're going to think about that speech, or they're going to think about how some people reacted to that speech and say, nah, we'll just get a different guy. We'll go to Shamar Moore, another light-skinned guy.
Shamar Moore.
There's another light-skinned guy across
we can get him around the corner.
So,
but it's interesting with the Jesse Williams thing is that I guess more of society, you would think, looking at him, you would think they say he's the unassuming Negro almost. Like, looking at him, you know, like, oh, he's not going to do nothing. He's not going to say nothing. We let him in the club, through the side door on the low. And he's also a microcosm of where we are going as future as period. As, you know, my older brother is biracial, but he's my complexion. So yep. it's a weird complex because he didn't know he was biracial and everything until we were 15. Because he was just brought in, you know, it's just like, hey, you know, this is always my older brother. He's always, and we're only a year apart. So he looks like every one of us. Like, we're all the same color. All of us brothers are all the exact same color. My youngest brother's actually lighter than us. And he's full black. And the brother that's above me, we're the same complexion. My younger brother is your complexion, but he's fully black. But the thing is, though, is that he has, I think when he found out, it felt like he got detached from his blackness to a certain extent.
Yeah,
like
I
almost
could see
like
that.
He felt betrayed
that
to a certain extent, though, finding out at 15 years old, you know, that your mom was is white. You know, it's like, hey, you ain't like us other three. You know, you kind of off on your own thing, but nobody treated him like that. But
yeah,
I've never had that real like conversation with him like that because we talk, but we don't talk. So when we do talk, it's like, man, I just wanted to keep it real cool and happy because we only talk maybe 3 times a year. So when we do talk, it's like, man, what's been going on with this? We catching up on, oh man, how your kids doing? And man, you see the game, you know, man, what's up with our Bulls? You know, things like that. And we never ever attack that. And I wonder with Jesse Williams though, he went against that aspect to a certain extent. And going back to his question towards you, how was that for you being biracial coming up? Was that a issue for you on both sides? Because my ex-girlfriend from college, to come from this question, this is like a bigger question and package. I remember one time she called me crying in medical school. She was like, I'm not black enough and I'm not white enough either though. And her mom is the white mom that took care of her and everything. Her dad was she's from Omaha, Nebraska. Same, you know, hustling dude from Omaha, living in Omaha from Chicago that moved to Omaha and everything like that. But she was like, yo, I'm not black enough. But she black as hell, though. She's a president of her sorority, you know what I'm saying, at her college, yeah. Black sorority, the whole nine. But it was like, and she had a kind of a situation like you where she went to medical school late. She just graduated medical school at 36. Hmm. So everybody else is younger than her. She's, you know, light skin. She's biracial. But I tell you, like you meet her, she's blacker than anybody else. Yeah. So how was that for you being packaged in that kind of environment? But you know, she always felt like she wasn't black enough and she wasn't white enough sometimes.
I think I was able to avoid a lot of that stress just, you know, by happenstance, because I think the majority of the people who I grew up around, and then even when I went to college and then in my professional life, have just always viewed me or treated me to my face as black. I've never really had anyone question that about me, especially when I was younger and, you know, maybe more vulnerable to, you know, that kind of stress or that kind of pain that something like that can cause. In general, I just think people in my life, for whatever reason, I don't know why, they just have viewed me as black and treated me that way and always referred to me that way, you know.
Kept it that way, yeah.
I mean, of course, you always get the light skin jokes. I mean, yeah, I always got that. Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I make those jokes too. About
right, yeah. We go back and forth. We can go back and forth all day. Right.
So
right.
I don't think that's ever been an issue for me. I think the biggest issue for me and my younger brother that we've probably faced the most is just a lot of times people not necessarily knowing what we are. Like, I've gotten that question, what are you, that kind of thing. But it's usually not from people who it's not from people who I'm close with or people who I really would be offended by their opinion one way or another. It's just in general kind of interactions with meeting someone new where people might mistake me for Hispanic, or, you know, people might mistake me for black and Asian or something like that, you know, or people would mistake my brother all the time for being Native American, which
really, for all I guess being in Minnesota, that would make sense though.
And which, for all I know, all those things could be somewhere. Right. They could be somewhere in
somewhere
us.
Somewhere down the line.
All I know is my mother's a white woman and my father is I wouldn't say a dark-skinned black man, but maybe a
nice
caramel color
brown
black
brother.
Man. Yeah, from Alabama. So.
Oh, so he... So he's from Alabama. What part of Alabama is he from?
I don't even know. I don't know what part of Alabama.
If he's from like Mobile, Birmingham, Montgomery, you know, or from the small towns, you know, those are different type of black men, you know, when it comes to that.
I'm pretty sure he's from a small town in Alabama, though, but because he's country.
Is he corn-fed country where it's like the big old guy was throwing hay?
No, but just very, very old school. Like, oh man, he calls the toilet the commode. Have you ever heard of that?
Yeah, I've heard people. That's old school though.
Yeah, it was very old school. He's the only person I ever met that did that, and he always called me sir. Even when I was a little boy, he would call me sir. That might be a down south thing. I don't know. Maybe my father thought I was a white man.
Maybe he was like, man, I gotta treat him with respect. Where I come from, you know, he was running everything.
I always found that funny though, that he always called me sir, even when I was a little boy, you know. So yeah, he just
fire joints. All right. So first one for the rapid fire, man. Top five rap MCs. This is a hip hop podcast. Top five rap MCs.
Oh my god, that's
it. Don't have
hard
to be any time. You don't have to do whatever you want to do. Some people want to do all time. Some people do it currently. Some people want
to. I'm gonna do all time, but do I have to do an order? Can I just
No. Okay. It might be no particular
order. Just my top
order.
Five. Okay, I gotta have Jay-Z in there. I gotta have Nas in there. I gotta have Big in there. I gotta have Tupac. Ooh, and that next one. Oh my god, that's
the fifth spot. Get you in trouble
one.
All the time. That people might be hitting you up on social media, like, I know why you pick a Ski-Lo for your fifth person.
It's none of these fools who are out now. it's none of them. Oh, let me see, man. Oh, that's a hard one. Man, I'm and this may change.
No, it's fluid. I always say the list is always fluid.
I'm gonna go ahead and put my boy DMX in that right now.
Ooh, why not? You see the interview you just had?
No, I did.
I know you sleep and everything in the middle of the day. Watch that new DMX interview on The Breakfast Club. It's an hour and 10 minutes though.
So speaking of Breakfast Club, I should have put my boy Birdman in there.
Put some respect on my name. Put some respect on my name. Hey, Birdman, man. Birdman's Birdman. So this is a part I call Don't Get Messed Up. So this is a section with rapid fire, this and that, or what do you think about? So you got to pick either one or. All right. So first up, Tupac or Biggie?
Tupac.
Tupac. All right. Jay-Z or Nas?
Oh, that's a hard one. Ooh.
So that's what I'm saying. You get people mad at you with these answers now.
Man, that's so hard. It depends what kind of mood I'm in. If I just want to hear some good music, man, it's probably Jay-Z.
Yeah.
But if I want to be real conscious, I'm thinking about Nas. All right.
Next up, if you had a choice in between going out on a limb to cover a story in Antarctica or going in the middle of the south side of Chicago on 4th of July weekend.
I go to Antarctica.
The key point is 4th of July weekend.
I'm staying out of Chirac, man.
South side, 57th Street. On 4th of July weekend, you got to sit out there with your news camera for 24 hours.
Nah, I'm going to Antarctica.
With 24 hours, you going to stand outside with your camera in the snow for 24?
I'm from Minnesota. I can do that.
You can do that. All right. I'm just saying. Belly or New Jack City?
Oh, man, that depends too. Nowadays, because I'm more into stories and like the quality of films, I'd say New Jack City. But back in the day when I was young, Belly.
Favorite hood movie of all time?
Oh.
Overall. Now let me qualify, because me and Javon have qualified what a hood movie is. Post 84, you have to be crack era epidemic movie.
Okay.
So it has to be after 84 and has to be placed in the hood or at least are actually involved four or more black people.
Yeah. That's a hard one too, and that one's always fluid, but right now I'm gonna say one of my favorite ones is Paid in Full.
We consider that the last hood classic movie.
I don't think there's
been any other hood classics since then.
Yeah, you're right.
Hood movies in the hood, but none that was a classic level
that
on that Paid in Full.
What else? I would say Belly's up there too.
Some people hate Belly, man. You'd be surprised how many black people hate Belly.
It's a good... They took a turn toward the end of that movie.
With the Africa thing?
Yeah, I don't know about that one, but the rest of it was good.
Jimmy said he's doing another one. That's why I want you to watch it. He said he's doing another one.
Okay.
He said that the whole time Buns is supposed to be in jail for 20 years. So basically this whole time, Buns is in jail. So I don't know what it was. His premise for it had me in, though. I don't know what the rest of the script was talking about, but for his part alone... I was cool, and I was already bought into it. All right, next up in Rapid Fires, favorite movie that you cried in that nobody knows about?
Oh, man. Field of Dreams.
Really?
You cried in Field of Dreams. Field of Dreams. The scene with his dad, and that probably goes back to something to do with my dad, you know, and that situation. If you go back to the scene where he's playing catch with his father out on the field, that's a real emotional scene for me. For whatever reason, I don't know what it is. And I never watched that movie until I was an older man. I didn't see that movie when I was a kid or anything like that.
So you didn't read the book or anything like that?
No, I was like in my 20s, late 20s when I saw that movie for the first time. So,
That's interesting. That's a first timer, though. Like they say, Field of Dreams. Okay.
That's one that gets
What is one artist that you kind of regretfully like where it's like, man, dude, I kind of like them, but people wouldn't think I would like them, but I like them. Guilty pleasure artist, more of anything. I phrase this wrong, but
and musician. Pleasure.
Yeah, musician. It could be rap, whoever, anybody.
You know, I like Selena Gomez's recent music, and it's so funny that you asked me that, because just 2 minutes before I came in here, I was reading an article from
Kevin Johnson,
ripping Selena Gomez.
Johnson's concert. Yeah, I read that.
I didn't go to her concert, but some of her songs I like.
So Selena Gomez is the boy. People are like, yeah. I want anything Anthony to be on that.
I listen to some of her songs I like.
All right, trap music all-star. We have a trap. Who is your trap music all-star?
Oh,
you may not
God.
Like trap music, but you like, you know what, I like him. For me personally, mine's like Yo Gotti.
See, like, I don't know that. Is that the guy who sings the DM song?
Yeah.
Yeah, then that's my guy, too. Because I like that song. See, I don't even know who sings it, but...
Yeah,
I like
him
song.
And like 2 Chainz too, man. Like I don't, like,
yeah.
I ain't gonna play with my daughter around. I might even just, but you know,
yeah.
I
like 2 Chainz. He got one of the songs. I can't even remember what the name of it is though. But he said something about he's talking about going through the metal detector. So that song, I always laugh and make fun with my wife about that song.
All right. So if your wife happened to just die, Lord forgive, die tomorrow. what woman, and you had one woman to get with, his, like, who would you get with?
Oh, man.
And like, keep in mind your wife, you are long and gone. He took a sabbatical for 3 years on top of you dying.
She said it's okay.
Yeah, she says she put it in the will. You got 3 years to be by yourself, and then I will give you condone to be with this person. Who would it be?
Oh, my gosh. That's a hard question, man. We was just talking about how crazy she is.
Right.
Holly Berry.
Did Holly Berry? You were still, keep in mind, 3 years on top of this, she'd be in her mid-50s almost. By the time you would get a chance at her.
I'd be the one to make it work. I'd be the one to make it work.
You'd be the one to make it all
to
right.
To make it work and make it all right. I'd help her heal.
All those kids, the young kids too, though. Now you got to restart over now.
It's okay.
You got a son that's 17. She got a young one.
Man,
young kid.
Hey. Older women are good, though. My wife is older than me. Just a couple months.
Awesome. I'm sure she'll be like, ah, it don't mean really nothing. All right, next up in the rapid-fire questions. If you had one person to interview ever, who would it be?
Ooh, wow, ever. Oh, man. You know, these people, though, I wouldn't even really want to
interview. They could be dead or alive. They could be whoever.
And I wouldn't want to interview them. I would just want to have, like, an off-the-record interview with them because I want it to be more real.
And more, yeah, and more, something where you just kind of have to do, and then this is something I want to do. Journalists have off-cuff conversations where they don't release it because it feels like journalists don't have that anymore. Like, everything is on the record even though it's off.
Yeah.
You know, so who is someone that you would
I got to do dead and alive.
Okay,
and,
do dead
and just dead and alive in my, like, in my view, because, you know, there are a lot of people in history who maybe I don't know a lot about, but I would say Obama and Martin Luther King.
Mm.
That's who
but
I would
yours
like
would be,
to.
Oh, you want an off-the-cuff
interview?
I want
off-the-record. I don't want to interview them for TV. I want to just talk with them on my own. Give me 30 minutes without the cameras to have a real
and
conversation.
And having a drink.
Yeah.
And of course, Martin Luther King would make you smoke cigarettes, too, at the same time.
Obama's smoking cigarettes.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, it would be a triumvirate of people smoking cigarettes, and you just have to sit there with your mic, or not even mic, just sitting there just, hey, what do you feel about this, this, and this?
Yeah, I'd say them too, but just for my own purposes, I'd want to talk with them.
All right, so this is the pivotal question here, though. Now, I told you about it before to come up with the question. With your played yourself moment where you was like, man, I really played myself in this situation.
Oh, so recently, this is with my job. Recently, I anchored a newscast for our station, and I don't know if everybody out there knows, but when you anchor, you're reading off a teleprompter. So there's basically a camera that you're looking at. And the words are in the camera. So the anchors aren't just ad-libbing or making up those words. They're reading a script that they're reading in the teleprompter. So we were all, it was the first time I was doing this specific show. We were all geared up, all hyped up. I told all my people, watch me at so-and-so, my mom, everybody. And then at the beginning of the show, they forgot to load the teleprompter, so there was no words in the screen at all. And I had to make up, like, the first three stories before they realized there were no words in the story.
So did you know the stories? You already looked through everything?
I knew somewhat, but I didn't know as much as I should have, and that's how I played myself, because had I not...
If you had prepared a little bit more to look through the stuff, you'd depend on the teleprompter too much.
Then I wouldn't have played myself, so yeah. And that was a little embarrassing. I played myself and learned a lesson. So.
Did anybody notice? Anybody tweet you anything? Like, or email you like, man, I caught you slipping, like, you know.
I'm pretty sure people at home just thought I just was messing up. They just, for whatever reason, they don't know what went wrong, but something went wrong because it looked messed up. So anybody watching knows that something went wrong.
All right, I didn't tell you this is going to be the last question. This is the last one, but this is one I had to. I sneak in on everybody. What's one situation where you played yourself with a woman?
Oh my gosh!
Now, don't get hurt at home. Now, don't get hurt at home.
Oh, with a woman. Oh, that's such a hard question, man. There have been so many times. So many times.
I give you an example from mine. I try to give people a new one because I play myself with a lot of women. So I got tons of stories. So.
Okay.
And I've been telling people lately about the time I tried to get at Megan Good. I was in L.A. and everything, hanging out and everything. She was outside smoking. She smoked cigarettes. I don't know if people know that she smoked cigarettes. So I don't smoke. Mm-hmm. So I went over to her and said, hey, can I get a cigarette? So keep in mind, I don't smoke for real. So like, I'll smoke cigars and hang out with it, but not cigarettes. So I'm sitting there smoking cigarettes, trying to talk. They're coughing. Like, see, obviously I don't smoke cigarettes because I'm sitting there coughing tremendously. yeah, you know. That I'm, but also I'm trying to be cool, too cool for school. Check, like, I don't know who she is. So I'm like, yeah, you know. So what do you do for a living? What, you work in modeling or something? Like, kind of like the scene from Boomerang with Eddie Murphy. Like, so, oh, was you coming for the casting call? For Strange, you coming for the casting call? And I'm like, say, you know, you probably just out here cute and everything. You know, you probably somebody sugar. I knew who she was when I did all this. She was like, oh, no, I'm an actress, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, so what you been in? She was like, a few things here and there. So she's basically not trying to talk to me at all, but I'm directly asking her directly, and she's giving me just kind of simple answers. So I'm trying to leave myself like, yeah, you know what, maybe we should hang out sometime and everything. So keep in mind, this is making good, and I'm trying to act like I'm coughing in between all these different things. So it's even worse because I'm looking like a herb sat there coughing in between because I don't smoke cigarettes, obviously, and I'm acting like it. But yeah, we can talk inside, though, and we'll talk to each other. She goes into the club, and then my boy's like, yeah, I saw Megan go out the side door. So she was playing me, so I never got the hell later. I thought I was in there, but I wasn't.
Well, at least she tried. I gotta
give you
credit.
Shoot my shot.
A lot of brothers just would have looked at her and not said nothing, so I give you credit for that.
You have a couple of drinks, man. You kind of just you throw it all on the crap table at that point.
Okay. All right. So I got one story happened. This was actually when I was in college. I was working part-time. It happened at a club, too. I was working part-time checking IDs at a nightclub.
So you weren't security. You were just checking IDs.
I wasn't security. I wasn't bouncing nobody, but I used to tell people I was a bouncer there, though, just
but
a
you,
joke.
Your official title was technically probably bouncer.
I don't even think I had a title. I just checked some IDs
so
at the door.
So they paid you just to check IDs?
Yep. Oh, like nothing, though. The real reward was being able to hang out in the club and talk to girls. That's
okay.
That's what you did the job for.
But so it wasn't really money for real.
No.
More
no,
of the experience of hanging
no.
out.
So this is when I was in college, and I met a girl in there. I was talking to her like the whole night and like clicking.
Yeah.
Like
yeah, everything
clicking.
Is moving. Yeah.
Everything's going. She was into me. We was going to hang out afterward. And like toward the end of the night, we were talking again. I mean, like, we were in. I was in there, man. And then I mentioned something about my son. And she looked at me and she said, you got a kid? And I said, yep. She turned way around and walked away from me. Didn't say two more words.
Hold on. Immediately. Like
immediately.
Was, like almost like you said you had syphilis or something.
She asked me. She said, you have a kid? And I said, yep. And then she walked right away.
You never saw her again ever in your
never
life.
Saw her again. She never said nothing to me. The rest of the night, gone. And I mean, we were supposed to kick it after the club as soon as I got off. Never happened. So
was she a student or was she
I don't know what she was. She just was a girl in there hanging out in the club.
Wow.
So that was a little lesson for me where I
keep that on the back burner until we talking for real.
Well, I probably should have just said that right away.
Oh, before you
instead of wasting my whole night talking to this girl, and then as soon as she learned something important about me, she had enough.
See, now, there's some
gone.
People that say, you should never tell her about no kids. Yeah, right. So there's some people that take another lesson from that, that'll go on the dark side of it and be like, should have never said nothing to after that night. Like, you know, I got a kid after already. So, you know. But, hey, man, thank you for coming on, though, man. I appreciate you coming on, hanging out. Let everybody know where if they want to contact you, talk to you, see you, all that different stuff, all your social media, all that good stuff.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. Thank you all out there for listening. You can watch me Monday through Friday on Channel 4 from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. You can also follow me on social media. All you got to do is put in Kiko, K-I-E-K-O-W.
So you just put doing on Google, you're the first one that pops up?
I'll pop up, yeah.
So it's not no other guy named Dan that because it's a guy that's saying I thought the same thing. There's a guy that robbed a bank in South Carolina with the same exact name as me, and he's black. So it's not like I could be like, we just put the click the black with the white guy.
If you look up Kiko and you see an Anthony there, odds are it's me.
What if your son's in the blowing up son of the your son be like, I'm popping pops. People would hit me up on Facebook. They hit me up on Twitter.
Well, for the next couple years at least, until he does whatever he's going to do, it'll just be me out there.
Okay. And then, so any you can Google that and hit up
yeah,
all, you know,
Google
all your
it, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, just K-I-E-K-O-W, and you'll find me, Kiko.
You have anything coming up big? Anybody seen needs the one to check for or anything like that? This
just,
is something I'm working on.
Just watch.
Just watch
in the morning. You know, that's what helps me out. That's what lets people know, you know, in my...
Especially if you got a Nielsen box.
Yeah, and if you got a Nielsen box in my station, because they look at those numbers every day. And they look at those numbers not only just for the entire newscast, but they look at the numbers for the 2 minutes that I'm actually in front of the camera.
So they break down the stats that hard?
Oh, yeah. They look at everything, man. That's the analytics stuff. They into all that. It's all about the numbers, because they take those numbers to the advertisers and say, look at how many people are watching us at 5 o'clock. You got to pay me
X amount of dollars
if you want your commercial.
If you want Anthony around your time slot, you need to pay me X amount, because these 3 minutes he on, it blows up with that.
Yep.
Well, man, thank you for coming on, man. I appreciate it, man. And, man, this is another edition of My Checker. Peace.
Nobody's doing this thing exactly like we do. They do it, they just ain't doing it like us. Suck ass motherfucker. My personal pedigree so bone.